From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in. Well, in the past two decades, our understanding of the navigational and physiological feats that enable birds to cross immense oceans, fly above the highest mountains, or remain in unbroken flight for months at a stretch has exploded.
What we've learned of these key migrations, how billions of birds circumnavigate the globe, flying tens of thousands of miles between hemispheres on an annual basis, is nothing short of extraordinary.
We'll speak with Scott Widensaw in the first part of the show. He is the author of the book, A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. Drawing on his own extensive fieldwork in A World on the Wing, Widensaw unveils the miracle of nature taking place over our heads.
Then in the second half of the show, we'll talk to Brandy Smith with the environmental nonprofit Utah Clean Energy. Utah Clean Energy is celebrating its 20-year anniversary, and Brandy will discuss the group's history, successes, and ongoing challenges associated with the state of clean energy here in Utah.
All that and some news set this past week for the highest daily level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, 421 parts per million, topping the previous record of 419 parts per million set in, yes, just 1 year ago this month. And you won't believe, we'll say this number. We'll share with you where we were when we started this show.
In
2006.
Well, you're full of good news this morning,
yes,
Chris.
As always.
Environmental awareness and education. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now for the first part of the show is author Scott Widensaw, here to talk about his recent book, A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. Scott, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Well, thanks. It's a real pleasure to be with you both.
Well, spring seems like a great time to talk about birds and their migration. So we're especially happy to have you here as we see the migratory birds come through town. But I have to ask, you know, you've written, you've been a prolific writer and you've written dozens of books. What about this topic sort of captured your attention, and what drove you to write about birds in A World on the Wing?
Well, this goes all the way back to childhood for me. I grew up in the mountains of eastern Pennsylvania, very close to a place called Hawk Mountain Sanctuary, which was the first sanctuary, the first refuge in the world for birds of prey. And these are migratory raptors that pass down along the Kittatinny Ridge every fall. Of course, there are now dozens of hawk watchers across North America, including some great ones in Utah. But hawk watching had its start in Pennsylvania, and I got hooked in the fall of my 12th year on hawk migration in particular, and migration in general. And 50 years on, that has just not let go of me. I've been passionate about bird migration because it's one of, if not the greatest natural spectacle out there. You know, the fact that there are billions and billions and billions of birds moving endlessly up and down and across the hemispheres every year in concert with the seasons. And, you know, it's a sort of thing that you don't have to, you know, go to some exotic part of the world. You walk out in your backyard at this time of the year and you have this pageant of migratory birds, you know, stitching the most distant parts of the world together.
I grew up in southern New Jersey, and I was, my gateway moment for birding was with respect to all the migratory birds that come down through southern New Jersey, stop at the Delaware Bay, and of course funnel through Cape May. Including raptors like that.
There's always been a little bit of a friendly rivalry between Hawk Mountain and Cape May. you know, and Cape May kind of shows off a little bit because they've got the raptor migration, the shorebird migration, right, the seabird migration, and the owl migration, and the warbler, you know, it just goes on and on.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, Hawk Mountain, I went to school in central Pennsylvania, and I never heard of Hawk Mountain until I went the school out there, and it was unbelievable the variety of birds that pass through there. But yeah, we could talk more about that. But to talk about, you know, some of the travels, I mean, the journey that some of these birds take, and it doesn't seem to be a function of their size either. You know, it's not like only big birds take travel great distances. small birds too can travel for weeks and weeks at it on the wing or so at a time. What are some of the, give us some examples and where their point A to point B is.
Sure. I mean, there's just, as you say, you know, size is not really a limit here. I mean, a lot of these birds are punching above their weight when it comes to migratory distance and migratory endurance. I mean, little semi-palmated sandpipers that are, you know, 6 inches long and weigh an ounce or so take off from the northeastern coast of North America and fly 3,300 miles nonstop across the Western Atlantic all the way to the northeastern coast of South America. It's like a 4 or 5 day journey, except black pole warblers that are half that big, that weigh less than an ounce, or less than half an ounce rather, are making that same trip, you know, something beating their wings like 4 million times.
Wow.
And, you know, and they're doing this all in a couple of grams of fat. That's the main fuel for most migratory birds. And some scientists a few years ago calculated that if black pole warblers were burning gasoline instead of fat, they would get 720,000 miles to the gallon, which, you know, puts your Prius in perspective, right. I think. But that kind of migration endurance is really fairly normal. You know, probably the single most astounding migration of any land bird that we know of are bar-tailed godwits, which are, you know, about the size of a pigeon. These are shorebirds that breed in western and northern Alaska. And these birds take off from the coast of Alaska and fly up to 11 days nonstop across the widest part of the Pacific Ocean all the way to their wintering grounds in New Zealand and the eastern coast of Australia. That's 8,100 miles of continuous powered nonstop flight. I mean, they don't land in the islands of the South Pacific. They're not waterproof. They can't rest on the water. And they're able to do that because prior to leaving Alaska, they feed ravenously for weeks. It's what's known as hyperphagia. It's basically binge feeding. They more than double their weight, so they're more than 55% fat. And when they no longer need their digestive system, they get rid of it. So in a matter of less than a week or so, their stomach, their intestines, to a lesser extent, their kidney and their liver shrink dramatically. They atrophy. So their digestive system is shrinking. Their chest muscles increase by 50% in mass without exercise. I would like to know how to do that. And their heart muscle mass increases 30 to 50%. And then they make this extraordinary flight to New Zealand, land, regrow their guts, and spend the austral summer down there feeding. And then they do the whole thing over again in the spring, except that they're going from New Zealand to the Yellow Sea between China and the Korean Peninsula, land, regrow their guts, you know, feed ravenously, guts shrink down again, fly another 4,000 miles back to Alaska. It's this huge triangular migration of about 18,000 miles a year, written across the biggest ocean mass on the planet. It's just extraordinary. And that's what we know about. I mean, there are still big migrations, I'm sure, epic migrations that we haven't even uncovered yet.
Right.
That leads really well into what I wanted to ask you about next, which is how do we know exactly where these birds, you know, are going and how long they're taking to do it and what route they're taking? Can you talk to us about some of the science or the technology that's being used to help us understand these birds' lives?
Sure, Nell. And that's actually what I've been most involved in over the last 25 years of doing migration research myself, is a lot of these new high-tech tracking devices. In the case of the bar-tailed godwits, it was a case of scientists in Alaska finally having satellite transmitters that were small enough and light enough to actually implant within the body cavity of these birds.
Wow.
With an antenna kind of sticking out of their abdomen so that they could track them in their migration. There's just been this explosion in new tracking technology, and some of it uses, you know, technology people are probably carrying around in their pocket right now. One of the species I study are snowy owls. We have something called Project Snowstorm, where we use GPS GSM transmitters that are solar powered, about as big as a matchbox. They fit in a little backpack harness on the bird's back, and they communicate with the GPS satellite system overhead. So they're continually logging highly precise latitude, longitude, altitude, flight speed information. And then a couple of times a week, they dial up through the cell phone network and they send us all of that data. And my standard joke is that my friends are cooler than your friends because I get text messages from snowy owls. But snowy owls are big. They weigh 4.5 to 6 pounds. But most migratory birds are much, much smaller than that. And until recently, it's been almost impossible to track them across, you know, large distances, you know, without basically having an air force to, you know, chase their little radio transmitters with an airplane. But now we have a combination of highly miniaturized radio transmitters. I mean, these are, some of these are small enough you can put them on monarch butterflies, and a network of automated receiver stations, something called the MOTUS Wildlife Tracking System, M-O-T-U-S, that's been spearheaded by a group called Birds Canada, but it's all over primarily the Western Hemisphere, increasingly across the West. There's more and more MOTUS stations going up in Utah and elsewhere in the West, and it allows us to track these animals, birds and bats and migratory insects, kind of effortlessly and without running around through the woods at night, you know, waving a radio antenna like I used to do years ago. And it's just unlocked so many secrets about where these birds are going and the kind of journeys that they're making.
As you know, an ornithologist, a scientist yourself, I'm curious how this kind of technology has maybe changed trends or interest in this field. Like, has it driven more people or more resources towards, you know, studying migration of birds or other species?
It absolutely has. And one of the ways that we've been studying migration is to tap into the information that the average birder is providing. There's, you know, this enormous observational database at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology called eBird, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with, where, you know, I go out birding in the morning and I keep a checklist on my phone of all the birds, species I've seen and individuals I've seen. At the end of the morning, I send that checklist through my eBird account to Cornell. Well, every year people put like 100 million sightings into eBird. That's given us this really detailed, granular, almost minute by minute picture of, you know, where birds are in what numbers and, you know, at what times. And that, along with the tracking data, and frankly, I mean, some of this tracking work, like the MOTUS network, those receiver stations only cost a couple of $3,000 to $4,000 to build. I know people who've actually built them in their own backyard to see what's migrating overhead. A lot of nature centers and similar institutions doing that. You start layering all of these new forms of big data. Doppler radar, you know, the radar that tells us if there's a thunderstorm or a blizzard coming, can also tell us exactly how many birds are flying overhead at night, because most birds migrate after dark, in the night sky where we can't really see them. And so, again, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology has created something called Birdcast. Birdcast.info is the web address. And they're crunching in real time every night all of the radar data from all of the 140-some radar stations across the lower 48 and calculating exactly how many birds are migrating over the contiguous United States. And many nights at this time of the year, it's something like 750 million birds, like 700 million birds migrating up there. And, you know, it's a click away on your computer.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Scott Weidensahl, the author of the book, A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. So, Scott, I think that last year, right around the same time, Chris and I did an interview with the folks from Birdcast to talk about Birdcast and how it worked and to help us understand how to use Birdcast and I guess other informational tools to help birds on their journey. And we wanted to make a little bit of time to talk about that as well. You know, how can we help these species in our own homes, in our own communities?
Well, there's a bunch of ways we can do it. And it doesn't require, you know, like moving to the woods and eating bark for the rest of your life. one simple way is just kind of share the love and let folks who might not be birders know how easy it is to understand what's happening around them. I mean, the pandemic really, I think, opened a lot of people's eyes to birds. And it's kind of a once in a generation opportunity for bird conservationists to harness all of these new people who've discovered how beautiful and amazing birds are. But we also know that because of radar, because of eBird, because of tracking technology, that urban light pollution is a huge problem for migratory birds. And so, you know, particularly during spring and fall migration, encouraging people and you know, from the municipal level on down, just to turn off their lights at night can make a huge difference, especially in the fall migration when most of the birds migrating are young birds on their first trip south. They're the ones that really get lured into urban areas. But what that also means is I think we have an opportunity to create life rafts for these birds. They're going to get drawn into urban areas anyway. And so urban parks and green spaces turn out to be really important as, you know, kind of fire escapes for these birds. You know, they've been migrating all night, daytime comes. And this is particularly true here in the East where I live, where you have these gigantic megalopolises like along the I-95 corridor. You know, daylight comes, the bird looks down, there's nothing but concrete, except there's, you know, Central Park in the middle of Manhattan or Fairmount Park in Philadelphia. And so by creating and enhancing bird habitat in those urban parks, I think we can make a big difference for tens to hundreds of millions of birds that depend on those areas during their migration every year. And we can do the same things in our backyards, you know, gardening with local native plants, avoiding using pesticides and insecticides in our backyards, planting, you know, even just a few native fruit producing shrubs that are going to help tanagers and thrushes and some other fruit-eating birds on their way south in the fall. That multiply that across millions and millions of backyards in the United States, and it can make a huge difference for birds.
All right, Scott, I want to go back to this, the migratory process, and maybe even on, say, an evolutionary scale, why birds do this. And, you know, I can understand on a kind of a simplistic level, you know, you're up in northern Canada, it's August, it's getting cold, you're running out of food, and the bird basically otherwise says, well, let's fly south. I don't know, let's go this way. But where in the process did they say we need to fly 3, 4, 6,000 miles in order to get
18,000 miles?
18,000 miles.
Right. So,
like, who was the first bird that did that?
First of all, we know migration's been going on for a really, really long time.
Yes.
I mean, there were, you know, bird migration probably dates back to the Cretaceous. Some of the, you know, early toothed birds that shared the world with dinosaurs. But the thing is, Chris, you're thinking about migratory birds backwards. We think of these as northern birds that take this little winter vacation south, right, and then come back where they belong. But the fact is, most migratory birds belong to groups that are inherently tropical in their origins. Wood warblers, thrushes, tanagers, flycatchers, hummingbirds. These are birds that are primarily tropical. And I think what you have to think about is North America and the Northern Hemisphere in general over the last 2.5 or 3 million years, with these successions of ice ages. We've had, you know, more than 20 ice ages in the last 2.5 million years. And during the ice ages, those birds get pushed back down toward down to the tropics and subtropics and temperate zones. And then as those glaciers retreat, you've got more and more land available in the north, more and more resources, longer days, lots of food. And so these birds, and we can actually see this still happening today with some species of birds that every year go a little farther north and a little farther north and a little farther north and then back where they came from, essentially, in the tropics. Species like pectoral sandpipers that have now colonized all the way across Alaska, they've crossed the Bering Strait. Every year they go farther and farther west across Asia and into Eurasia. And in the fall, they, instead of going south into Asia, they come back across the Bering Strait, back across Alaska, and down into the New World tropics, because that's kind of where they came from. So, I mean, you got to take the long view. But now, things like the bar-tailed godwit flying across the Pacific, many bar-tailed godwits that breed in Eastern Asia fly down to Australia by taking a largely land route through Asia. And probably the ones from Alaska did that initially as well. But within any group of migratory birds, because migration is basically genetically coded, they don't, you know, learn where to migrate, you get some that go the wrong way. And some of those birds probably just headed straight out over the Pacific Ocean because they knew they had to go that way. And by God, it worked. And they wound up in places like New Zealand where there were no mammalian predators. It was like the land of milk and honey. And they survived. They passed those genes on to the next generation. And we can actually see that happening right now with Western hummingbirds that traditionally migrated south into Mexico. But you get some with, you know, they're born with bad software. And instead of going south, they make a left turn and they wind up here in New England where I live. Anna's hummingbirds, Rufus hummingbirds, a whole bunch of them. And they find that they're well adapted to this climate. Many of them end up wintering in the Gulf states. They fly back and pass on those once faulty genes to a new generation. So we can actually see migration evolving right before our eyes with some species.
Scott, we got a question from a listener who says, this is amazing, exclamation point. What is your favorite sighting or migration?
Oh, man.
that's a hard one.
That is hard to say. I mean, look, I've been a raptor nut all my life. And and so, you know, for example, the fall of 1992, I was part of a team that first documented what has proven to be the world's largest migration of raptors in eastern Mexico, in Veracruz State in Mexico. I mean, like, you get, in some cases, a million birds a day.
Wow.
Passing through a count site at a place like Cardel. But I have to tell you, a couple of years ago, and this is a story I tell in this book, I had an opportunity to travel to northeastern India and to a remote area called Nagaland, where millions and millions of Amur falcons pause on their migration. They're coming from their breeding grounds in Siberia and Mongolia and northern China, and they're traveling all the way to southern Africa, including 2,400-mile flight across the Indian Ocean. And they stop in Nagaland in late October and early November to feed on emergent trillions of winged adult termites that are emerging from underground on their mating flights, because these falcons are primarily insectivorous. And, you know, you watch like 100,000 of these falcons emerge from a couple of acres of forest at daybreak as they started to spread out from these nighttime roosts. And, you know, the sound of their wings overhead was like a rushing waterfall. It was just really one of the most astounding natural spectacles on the planet. And we didn't know a thing about it, us in the outside world, until 10 years ago. So that's why I say I think there's a lot of wonders and migratory miracles still yet to be discovered.
I got a text from a young listener who wants to know, when birds are migrating for days and days, flying for days and days at a time, are they awake the entire time, or do they somehow get a quick nap on the wing?
That's a great question. That's a wonderful question. Actually, we know birds can fly continuously, not just for months, but for years. Sooty
wow.
terns that breed in the tropical Pacific and Caribbean, when they leave their nesting island as a fledgling, they don't come back to land until they're old enough to breed at the age of 4.5 or 5. And so they just simply roam the Pacific Ocean for years, and they're not waterproof, so they can't sleep on the water. So what they and other migratory birds are doing is something called unihemispheric sleep, where they're able to put half of their brain to sleep for anywhere from a couple of seconds to a couple of minutes at a time. And they just kind of keep bouncing consciousness back and forth, you know, from one hemisphere to the next. Marine mammals do this too. Whales and dolphins, manatees, that have to consciously breathe. They can't go completely to sleep or they'll drown. And if you've ever had a bad night's sleep, the first night you were sleeping in a hotel room, that's called first night effect. And it's where part of your brain doesn't go completely to sleep. Hmm. So, I don't know. My wife accuses me all the time of only listening to her with half a brain. So maybe I'm unihemispherically sleeping when I do that. But that's how birds are able to do this. Like black swifts that breed in the Western United States, they winter in South America. We just discovered published in the last couple of months that black swifts spend about 9 or 10 months in more or less continuous flight when they're in migration and on their wintering grounds in South America. So they're doing unihemispheric sleep to stay awake.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're looking at each other like, this is incredible.
Some of this stuff sounds like it gets ripped out of science fiction.
Right.
I swear I'm not making it up.
Well, what changes, kind of shifting things here, what changes are occurring now with respect to migratory patterns and a warming world?
Well, yeah, that's one of the big questions right now is, you know, what effect is climate change having on bird migration? What effect is it going to have on bird migration? I mean, one of the most obvious issues for migratory birds is that spring is coming earlier and earlier every year. You know, it's advancing by weeks compared to just 50 years ago. And yet, as I said before, bird migration is basically encoded in a bird's DNA. It just doesn't make a decision that it's time to migrate. It just knows it needs to go now. And so consequently, birds are not keeping up with these changes. I just did a piece for the current issue of Audubon magazine about how the changing phenology, the changing timing of spring is affecting migration. And the real risk here is of what scientists call a phenological mismatch, where the birds get so far out of sync with the seasons that the resources, especially the food resources that they need, are no longer available. And you have to remember that most birds that breed in the Northern Hemisphere are timing their migration so they can get back, find a mate, set up a territory, build a nest, lay their eggs, hatch those chicks so that the chicks are at their hungriest during the part of the spring when especially insects are at their most abundant, especially soft-bodied caterpillars, because that's mostly what insect-eating birds are feeding their babies. And if they get too far out of sync, they're in real trouble. And we saw that happen starting in the 1980s in Europe with a bird called the pied flycatcher, which migrates from tropical Africa up to Central and Western Europe, breeds in the oak forests of Europe. It depends on that seasonal peak in caterpillar numbers. And starting in the 1980s, they got so far out of sync with the seasons that their populations dropped by 50% in the UK, as much as 90% in parts of Europe. Now, there's some good news here with the pied flycatcher, because the rapid warming that started happening in spring in Europe in the 1980s paused starting about 2014. Now, the scientists studying this want to stress it's not like global warming stopped in Europe. It's just that during that really critical period, this rapid warming slowed down, but it allowed the birds to catch up. And the pied flycatchers evolved an earlier arrival date, and their populations are doing really well again. So, you know, I think if we could, birds are resilient. I think if we give them half a chance, but, you know, the changes are coming so fast at them right now. I mean, we're seeing a phenological mismatch in the central and eastern Canadian Arctic, where late winter and early spring have gotten dramatically colder and snowier, which is one of the weird effects you get sometimes with climate change, whereas summer has become dramatically hotter. So these birds are arriving on their usual timetable. They have to wait and wait and wait much later than usual to start breeding. And then summer kicks in with a vengeance. The insects on which their chicks depend are actually emerging earlier than they once did. And so for species like Hudsonian godwits that have just migrated 9,000 miles from southern South America, many years only 5 or 6% of their chicks manage to survive because there just isn't enough food for them. So there are some serious challenges out there for migratory birds.
And the food sources themselves and the habitat is changing too. So it's not just that you have this this timing that
no,
is being
no,
impacted.
No, you're absolutely right.
But food sources themselves, the insects themselves are the caterpillars are being impacted by climate. So there's a lot of knock-on effects or a combination of impacts going on here.
Yeah, there certainly are. I mean, think about how important weather systems, predictable right. weather systems and wind patterns are for bird migration. The only reason that bar-tailed godwits can fly across the Pacific is because they have predictable, strong tailwinds during the first part of their journey. And, you know, the folks at Cornell have been doing a lot of modeling in the last couple of years, looking at what we know about migration today and what's being predicted for changes in particularly wind patterns and wind intensities. And they're finding that in some parts of the Western Hemisphere, at some times of the year, conditions are going to get more favorable for bird migration, be more tailwinds. At other times of the year, the conditions are going to become less favorable with stronger headwinds. How that's going to play out for particular individual species, you know, many of our neotropical migrants winter in the Caribbean and southern Mexico, northern Central America, in areas that are predicted to become much drier under new climate regimes. We don't know how that's going to play out for these birds. So there is a lot coming at them right now. And, you know, birds have gone through major climate shifts, you know, over the last tens of millions of years, but I don't think they've ever gone through climate shifts coming at them as rapidly as what we've cooked into the system at this point.
Well, Scott, I hate to say this, but, you know, we have to wrap up. We could talk to you about this all day, I think, but we have to wrap up. If listeners are interested in, you know, learning more about birds and bird migration, where would you direct them?
Well, I mean, I've talked a lot about the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, but they are really kind of become the one-stop shop for all things birding and ornithological. They're all about birds.org. Website is a really good source. If you're interested in learning more about the birds around you, Cornell's Merlin app will help you identify birds by sight and by sound. And I'm not just saying that because the guy that runs the Merlin sound, the Merlin system, is one of my former research technicians who's gone on to great things. It has helped a lot of people figure out what it's around them. And that's the first step to appreciating what you have out there.
Well, thanks again, Scott. That's Scott Weidensahl. He's the author of A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks, Scott.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us is Brandi Smith. She is communications director or so with Utah Clean Energy. And as I said, Utah Clean Energy just is celebrating its 20th year of existence.
20 years of impact. It's amazing.
Yeah. Okay. So 20 years ago, I'm going to take a guess. You weren't with Utah Clean Energy 20 years ago, but what was, say, Utah Clean Energy's original mission and objectives, and how have things gone over these past 20 years?
You know, the beautiful thing is Utah Clean Energy was founded by our current executive director, Sarah Wright. Mm. And so she started off with an organization recognizing that the way we use energy and how much energy we use was setting us on a path for destruction. So our mission really hasn't changed all that much in 20 years. We, at our heart, are a climate change organization. Mm-hmm. So we're looking to empower Utahns, businesses, families with the tools to turn the tide on climate change. That means switching to renewable energy. That means getting into those electric vehicles. That means energy efficiency in our homes and businesses. The amazing things is the tools are all there. They're at our fingertips. They're more affordable than ever. And we've had a small role to play in that over the past 20 years. It's really been quite the ride.
How have you seen the focus or the projects change that the organization has taken on over this time?
That's a really good question. You know, there it's kind of an ebb and flow thing. You know, when Utah Clean Energy was founded, there was next to zero renewable energy in Utah. Talking about climate change in the halls of the Capitol was walking a political tightrope. You know, nobody was thinking about energy efficiency or energy code. So we've changed all that. But with that comes pushback. We have to defend a lot of the policies that have gotten us here. And we're also relentlessly driving for, we need more renewable energy. We need to pick up the pace. We have 10 years to do some really bold things. And so the change has really been, you know, okay, you know, we might not be trying to convince people that climate change is an issue, but what we're doing is saying the economics are there. We need to go harder and faster than ever before.
When you say renewable energy, what are the primary examples of that?
So in Utah, we have great renewable energy resources. We have geothermal, we have solar, we have wind, and those are all projects that continue to grow in Utah. I think to date, we have enough geothermal, wind, and solar to power something along the lines of 645,000 Utah homes. That's no small drop in the bucket. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a lot of renewable energy. And there's more, and we've barely scratched the surface, really, of the potential we could do for more of all of that.
How have businesses or the free market embraced renewable energy here in Utah over these past two decades?
You know, it's an ever-growing issue for businesses. I remember learning about Uinta Brewing, I think was one of the first businesses to go solar way back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a big win. Then fast forward, this isn't necessarily business, this is local government, but you know, the Salt Palace installed a huge solar system on their rooftop that at the time was the largest in the West. Mm. And so I think businesses recognize two things, that we all there's a corporate responsibility factor. And when, you know, we see wildfires, when we're dealing with extreme drought, you need to be a part of the solution and your customers want to see that. So we see more and more businesses, you know, eBay is here, Adobe's here, they're doing amazing things to reduce their carbon footprint. So there's definitely a commitment there. But there's also a need for the business voice to demand more from our policymakers, from our governments, to say we need more access to clean energy, we need more access to energy efficiency and these kind of solutions.
So with this big milestone of 20 years of impact, what's the organization planning?
Oh, man. Oh, man. So we're actually, coincidentally, this year is we're in the middle of a capital campaign for building what we're calling the Climate Innovation Center. It's going to be not only Utah Clean Energy's new headquarters in Salt Lake City, but we're renovating a 70-year-old building that, while structurally sound, has never been updated to be what will be one of the most high-performance buildings in Salt Lake City. And that's a really big push for our organization. You know, buildings, homes in our buildings represent something along the lines of 40% of U.S. climate warming greenhouse gas emissions. So we really have to tackle our homes and buildings. And we do that by not just building new homes energy efficient, but we need to renovate. We need to look at our existing building stock that we're going to be stuck with for many years to come and say, how do we make these better? So the Climate Innovation Center is going to be certainly a teaching tool that we want to leverage for other businesses, for other community members to come and learn. How do I renovate to be energy efficient or net zero, which is what our building is going to be? How do we change our current building structure? And that's a big priority for us, the Climate Innovation Center.
How about building codes? What are the challenges associated with, say, getting municipalities, other government agencies to establish more energy efficient building codes, et cetera? I'm thinking about how the state legislature plays a role in establishing building codes, saying yay or nay to those things.
Yeah.
Okay.
You hit the nail on the head. Chris, I think you must know about this because it's going on right now. Okay. So Utah Building Energy Code is specifically the minimum code that we use in our homes and buildings to look at how much energy that home is wasting or using, and therefore how much pollution it's causing. Utah's energy code is woefully out of date. Our homes are, I think, building on the 2015 International Energy Conservation Code, so that's 7 years out of date. But right now, this month, a little-known group called the Utah Building Code Commission is reviewing energy code options, where Utah Clean Energy is one of the only nonprofit organizations working to advocate for updated building code. And so the UBCC, the Utah Building Code Commission, is reviewing it right now, considering what elements of the current 2021 building code, energy code, can we adopt, or if not all of it. And it's up to them to recommend code updates to the Utah legislature. So if they don't recommend it, we're in a bit of a pinch. Mm. But if they do recommend it, then we go to the Utah legislature next year with those codes, and we make the case for all the millions of dollars in benefit that Utah families are going to get, the massive amounts of pollution we're going to prevent. And, you know, we're talking about also an affordable housing solution as well.
So who makes up the Utah Building Code Commission? Mm.
You know, I wish I had that answer off the top of my head. You're not getting the best person for that answer today. I know
we'll dig in with a policy wonk next for this.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't have the exact makeup right now, but it's made up of a combination of certain building professionals and advocates, but I don't know the exact breakout.
It is interesting that a code that is just 6 years old, let's say you say it's the 2015 energy code that's being applied right now. That doesn't sound so long ago, but yet I guess that's an insight into how much things have changed in just 6 or 7 years with respect to building efficiency and opportunities to be more, to have buildings constructed more energy efficiently.
Well, there's the interesting thing about energy code is that we're not asking the builders to, you know, install anything that isn't tried and proven. Mm-hmm. This isn't like new wave technology. We're talking about better insulation. We're talking about a tighter building envelope. It's super common sense stuff. But the thing is Utah's booming. We are building like crazy right now. We're growing, and that means more energy demand. And so with every building that's built out of date, that's another building that all of us are stuck with that is needlessly wasting energy.
What would you say Utah Clean Energy's big wins have been over these 20 years?
Let's see. I would say it's hard to pick.
Right.
But I think the renewable energy growth in Utah is definitely a stamp of pride for our team. Again, we've gone from zero to over 2,000 megawatts of large-scale solar, wind, and geothermal. There's also, there was a time, I think it was between about 2006 to 2007, that rooftop solar and solar in Utah in general was doubling year after year. And that doesn't happen, you know, by chance. That happens because we passed pro-solar policies that empowered Utahns to put solar on their home and power their lives. So doubling solar was a huge win. Electric vehicles have become a really big priority at Utah Clean Energy. In 2015, Utah was the fastest growing EV state. Coincidentally, that also came on the tails of Utah Clean Energy hosting a bulk purchase program for electric vehicles, the first of its kind in its state, and also passing some, you know, pro EV policies at the legislature. So that was a big win. Just recently, in the past few years, Utah Clean Energy launched what we call the Utah Climate and Clean Air Compact. And the idea was, let's bring new voices to the table on this issue, because climate is just one of those things, we're not talking about it enough, and we need to always hear from new voices, or those voices that maybe you wouldn't think care or are working on this issue, those business voices, those Utah leaders. And so we launched the compact really to just put common sense dialogue forward around climate change and begin moving those voices towards what solutions. And I think right now there's something like 150 different compact signatories that have all stepped up and said, climate change is an issue. We have the solutions. Let's get to work.
So when we think about renewable energy and climate change within the state of Utah, do you see this becoming like an increasingly partisan issue, or do you see that partisan sort of divide on these topics decreasing a little bit?
It's decreasing, absolutely. Okay. And that was a big push with the Climate and Clean Air Compact, was let's cross that partisan divide. You know, Utah's an interesting place because, you know, if we can just, I think, meet on our common values, we all love our kids, we all want clean air, we all want to have a quality of life that we've enjoyed in this amazing state our whole lives. And so it's just about protecting that. I think we can always come, once you kind of can meet in the middle and just have some open conversations, the solutions are right there. They're more economic than ever. It usually just takes a few conversations to realize we have more in common than we realize.
Well, that's encouraging news.
Where would you say our two senators stand with respect to renewable energy, Senators Lee, Senator Romney? Are they advocates, would you say? Or
I don't know that I could speak to that. I know that, you know, Congressman Curtis is the founder of the Conservative Climate Caucus.
Yeah, and really so interesting, to be honest with you. Would not expect that, but yeah, that's great.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and you're talking about, you know, it's got a lot of members, and so getting that dialogue moving is a huge first step, and we're definitely looking to see what, you know, what happens with that organization, and we're there. We want to be, you know, a support system to provide some solutions, to provide some guidance and help anywhere we can.
So where are the challenges going forward in these next 20 years?
Well, one of the big challenges is time. We, you know, this is the climate decade.
We don't have 20 years.
We don't have 20 Okay. years. We really have to drastically reduce emissions in the next 10 years
Yes.
if we're going to be able to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change. And I say that because, you know, we can't say we're avoiding climate change. We're dealing with wildfire season. We're dealing with it in our own backyard today. So timing is certainly a big factor. I think one of the big challenges that we're dealing with, we've already talked about energy code, but this idea of, you know, trying to get the message across that nobody owns the sun, nobody owns the wind. This is also about national security and energy security, and the potential there is big. So I think a lot of it is just messaging, the realization that it's not, that, I guess what I'm trying to say is that the messaging that we have the solutions. We're just disagreeing about, I think, semantics now.
Hmm. Getting back to a specific electric cars, is that a area of growth that you see continuing to expand?
I do. And there's a lot of momentum here in Utah for infrastructure. So just in the late last year, a program we worked on with Rocky Mountain Power called the Electric Vehicle Program, the EVIP, it put something like $50 million in new funding for electric vehicle charging in Utah. They're going to double the amount of fast chargers in Rocky Mountain Power's territory. They're going to make it more easier for people living in apartments or condos to have electric vehicle charging. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of emphasis there for just addressing that major gap for EVs, which is, will I be able to get where I need to go? And that really comes down to charging, and we're expanding rapidly in Utah.
How about the solar industry? What challenges do you see there? I know, say, for example, there's issues with respect to supply, the supply chain coming out of, say, China or so. There's issues with respect to affordability, et cetera. What, you know, is the solar industry, what is the health of solar industry right now?
They haven't,
say, in Utah, I might want to focus on.
In Utah specifically, yeah. Well, I know for the rooftop installers, and these are a lot of great companies because a lot of them are local. A lot of them are homegrown small businesses, which we really want to support. Mm-hmm. You know, they've had some ups and downs over the past few years. A few years ago, what's called the solar export credit rate was changed. And so there's no longer net metering, which is a one-to-one credit. They do get a really good credit for the solar they export to the grid, but it's not quite as much as it was. So that put a shockwave through the industry, and a lot of installers had to adjust. I think most were able to make it through and survive, but it required, you know, some savvy adjustments. They had to become kind of lean. It's bounced back, I think, to an extent. I think they're good and busy. There's a lot of people going solar still. And on the utility scale side, I think you are correct. We were just at a solar site the other week, a large scale utility site, and they're ready to go, but they're waiting on solar panels, and that's a major issue. So we have to deal with that. That's a big issue. That's certainly not a state issue, but they're facing that issue currently.
Well, we have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure we talk about ways for people to get involved, maybe help you guys celebrate your 20th anniversary. What are the major programs or areas of opportunity for volunteers or supporters?
You know, we always say this, but it never gets old, is our leaders need to hear that they have the support of their constituents on climate. So everybody feels, I think, intimidated to email or call your representative. Like you have to know, like you have to be a climate expert. But you don't. You really, it is just a matter of an email or of a call saying, I just want to let you know that you have my support for any climate legislation that you want to push forward. If we can address air quality, if we can address climate change, and you know, maybe talking about, I have solar or I drive an EV, can you help make that easier for more people? Making your voice heard and making sure our elected officials know that you support that is huge in Utah.
Website?
UtahCleanEnergy.org. And I wouldn't be able to show my face in the office again if I didn't say that we are in the middle of the capital campaign. Yeah. And you can support the Climate Innovation Center now by going to UtahCleanEnergy.org. You'll see there's a webpage dedicated to learn all about the building, who we're working with, the different building managers that are helping us get to net zero. And you can email our development director to learn how to get involved with that project.
Well, that's an incredibly exciting project. And we also want to congratulate you all on 20 years of impact here in the state. Thanks for all your work.
Thank you.
Brandy Smith, Communications Director with Utah Clean Energy. We got one news item we want to cover. And it's actually relevant to what we just got talking to, in effect, with Brandy about renewable energy and the consequences of not turning to more renewable sources, like Brandy mentioned, wind, solar, and geothermal in the state of Utah, because the latest annual concentrations of carbon dioxide, the Keeling curve, that measured out of the observatory in Mauna Loa in Hawaii, are out, and no surprise, we continue to climb. We broke a record that was set last year. The record was 419 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We are now at 421 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And Nell and I are looking at a little chart that shows the increase year over year. And remember, back in 2006, 2007, when the show first started, we were at roughly 375 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And over these 20 years or so that we've had our show, 16 years, we're now up to 419. We can't go much higher, but this is kind of a, this is a linear increase year over year. It's almost, if you look, go back, it's almost nonlinear. Yeah. We've got to get this thing to flatten out first, not, you know, before we can keep it from just going down. Ultimately, we'd like to see it get back down below 410 or near 400. So that's where we are. 421 parts per million. It's at the highest concentration in May, because that's when we have the lowest amount of carbon dioxide uptake from plants, because it's winter time. So actually, the concentrations will tick down over the course of the summer and fall. We'll get maybe down to 420 or 419, then we'll go back up from there. So that's where we are.
Remember when we talked about keeping it to 350, getting into, it seems like those idealistic, naive. Yeah. We talked about when would we hit 400. Well, here we are. We've flown past it.
Speaking of flying by,
that's right.
It's the end of our show.
And it's time to wrap up. You can email us your thoughts, your comments, and your ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Let's again thank our guest today, our first guest, Scott.
Yeah, we want to thank Scott Weidenthal, a scientist, ornithologist, and author who wrote the book A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. Fascinating read.
Fascinating read.
Highly recommend.
Unbelievable information. Birds, incredible. Okay.
All right, you're lost for words.
Yeah, I'm lost for words. But let's thank Brandy Smith, too, Director of Communications with Utah Clean Energy. That's utahcleanenergy.org.
And as always, the interviews for today's show will be posted on the KPCW website later this morning, and you can also listen to the show anywhere you find your podcasts.
Thanks again for joining us. And remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM, Park City. Tune in and listen like a local. We'll see you next week. We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.